largest business group. Assembly Speaker Robin Voss said temporary waivers of Wisconsin's one-week waiting period and work search requirements for unemployment benefits will be allowed to expire early next year. The work search waiver was first instituted through an emergency order from Governor Tony Evers in March. When that order expired, his administration worked with lawmakers to approve an emergency rule to extend it. Those extensions were approved by the GOP-controlled rulemaking committee in September and November, with the latest extension now set to expire February 2nd. During the virtual meeting with Wisconsin manufacturers and commerce members on Wednesday, Voss argued the waivers should not be extended again because Wisconsin's unemployment has come down to a much more manageable number. The state unemployment rate was 5.7% in October, down from a high of 13.6% in April. The state's Legislative Audit Bureau is recommending the Wisconsin Economic Development Corporation make several changes to how it oversees Foxconn's tax credit program when it comes to employees. That story comes from Wisconsin Public Radio's Corrine Hess.
While the Taiwanese giant has yet to actually receive any state tax credits, the Nonpartisan Bureau's latest report has found issues with the way the Wisconsin Economic Development Corporation would administer certain credits. The report found WEDC would not give tax credits for the wages paid to Foxconn employees who live in other states but work here, even though they should. At the same time, the audit found the agency would incorrectly allow Foxconn to receive credits for employees working outside Wisconsin. This is the second time the Bureau has raised concerns with WEDC about employees working out of state being eligible for tax credits. WEDC Secretary Missy Hughes responded with a letter saying she's looking at modifying current procedures. Corrine Hess, Wisconsin Public Radio.
Now 12 minutes after 8, just ahead of the morning show with Greg Berg, let's check WGTD sports and weather. College basketball last night, the UW Badgers beat Rhode Island 73-62. In the NFL, Thursday night football, the Patriots meet the LA Rams. Coming up on Sunday, the Packers play the Lions in Detroit at noon. The Bears host the Houston Texans at Soldier Field, also a noon start. Now the WGTD forecast from the National Weather Service for this Thursday, December 10th. Sunny and continued mild, today's high heading for 50. Overnight, clear, 35. Friday, cloudy, 30% chance of rain, a high of 43. And we do want to alert you to Saturday. It'll be a little different weather depending on where you live. A rain-snow mix is likely. There will likely be some moderate accumulation in the western parts of our listening area, but also likely none near Lake Michigan. Saturday's high, 37. And to wrap up the weekend, Sunday, partly sunny and 33. The numbers right now, wind is calm, sunny sky, 32 degrees in both Racine and Kenosha, 28 for Burlington, Elkhorn, and Lake Geneva. For WGTD News, I'm Dave McGrath. 8:13, the morning show with Greg Berg is next.
And we welcome you to the Thursday Morning Show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. We are originally scheduled today to have an interview with the new director of the Racine Public Library, Angela Zimmerman. Unfortunately, something came up with Angela Zimmerman, and she asked to postpone our interview. Right now, we are tentatively scheduled to record an interview a week from today, and that interview is scheduled to air a week from tomorrow. In its place, today, we're going to be hearing an interview out of the Morning Show archives from way back in 2004, which nevertheless could not be more timely. It's a conversation about depression. And this is one of many interviews which I have recorded over the years with therapist Amy Sprague Champeau. And in this conversation, we explore what depression is and what we can do about it. And at this point in time, when so many people are struggling with depression and anxiety due to the ongoing COVID-19 pandemic and other stresses and fears, I think this is an important conversation for us to share with you today. And we welcome you to this Monday morning show on WGTD 91.1 FM, your gateway to public radio. I'm Gregory Berg. It seems odd on such a beautiful, cloudless day to be talking about depression, but that is our topic today. We'll be speaking in a minute or two with therapist Amy Sprague Champeau in anticipation of National Depression Screening Day, which is this Thursday. And we're going to be talking today about what depression is, the kind of factors that can make people especially vulnerable to it, what it is, what it is not, and the means we have to treat depression. The morning show airs every weekday morning between 8 and 9 o'clock. We remind you that our program is archived on WGTV's website. Again, we welcome a psychotherapist, Amy Sprague Champeau, back to the morning show. We welcome you.
Nice to be here.
And I'm glad we can talk about such an important topic. One of the things we were just bandying about is the fact that we tend to misuse the term depression. We often will say sort of offhandedly, boy, I'm depressed. The Packers lost. Or some other, you know, kind of bad thing occurred. When in fact, it's probably not a good idea for us to misuse the term or to use it lightly. Let's talk about first, what depression is, what we should mean when we use the term.
Well, depression is, first of all, a very common mind and body disorder. And mostly we think about it as a mind disorder, but some of the symptoms are actually physical. And so that's one of the ways to think about it, is a whole body problem, mind and body. And it's really common. It affects about 13 to 14 million Americans each year, which is quite a few people.
Yeah.
And approximately half of them seek treatment. So there are many people who may be actually clinically depressed who are not in treatment. And that's a problem because, as we may talk about later, many people who end up committing suicide, and often that is related to depression, are not in treatment. So that's significant. But the mind and body are affected at the same time. And what we're talking about here, you were talking about the word depression that we use kind of in place of sadness. Here we're talking about a clinical depression, which is a diagnosable set of symptoms that adds up to suffering for people. And some of those symptoms, well, first of all, let me back up. There are a number of different types of depression, too. So I think that's interesting to note that there are four or five different types of depression. And the difference in the types depends on the level of symptoms and the duration of the symptoms. So, but they're all treatable, and approximately 80% success rate when people enter treatment.
Wow.
So that's quite high. Sometimes when it's not responsive, there may be other factors involved, like medical illnesses that may appear as depression. So since there are these physical components, I usually recommend that people have a full physical workup and see their primary care physician first if they're feeling signs and symptoms of depression.
Yeah, I suppose if someone is feeling
for instance, sluggish, or they can't sleep or something, something which can be a symptom of depression, those can also be symptoms of other things that really have nothing to do with depressions.
Right, and especially things like hormonal imbalances and thyroid disease and things like that can have some of the same symptoms like fatigue and inability to concentrate and changes in weight and things like that. But depression is often episodic. It does often recur in people. It doesn't always last. There are types of depression that last and types of depression that seem to kind of come, hit a peak, and go away. But if it's not treated, it can result in trouble in relationships, trouble in families, decreased productivity, inability to work, and, you know, in the worst case scenarios, death even. So it's important that National Depression Screening Day is there to increase awareness of the symptoms and to encourage people to obtain treatment for themselves or somebody that they care about. And often people who are depressed may not be the first people to recognize those changes in themselves. It could be other people that are around them or who live with them. Because some of the signs, and I can go through some of the symptoms that we use to diagnose depression, but some of them may not feel bad to the person. For example, maybe wanting to be alone. That may not necessarily feel like something that is depression for people. They may just feel like they have this need to be alone more often.
Wouldn't be necessarily an ominous thing.
No.
I mean, it's not like the urge to cut yourself, for instance. I mean, right. any reasoning person would realize that this is not right. But just wanting to be alone, on the surface of it, might not seem like a symptom of some kind of trouble.
Right, and sometimes people can see that as a something like that, wanting to be alone. They could say, well, I'm with people all the time and I need to be alone. But it's when it's a change from your usual way of being. But some of the symptoms of depression, and then first we can talk about a major depressive disorder. So that's a depression that's very strong, that has a number of the symptoms I'm going to talk about, that lasts 2 weeks or more and impairs functioning. So I think when we were talking before, we were talking about the difference between sadness and depression. One difference in diagnosing a clinical depression is that there should be impaired functioning. I mean, that's sort of implied in a diagnosis of depression, meaning that one's functioning at home with their family isn't as good. Maybe they're not as productive. Their work is affected. It's hard to get out of bed. But for a major depression, there need to be one of these two symptoms, a depressed mood most of the time, and decreased interest or pleasure in activities. One of those, plus four of the following, and there's a long list that I'm going to read. So these are the ones that are in that group. Change in appetite or weight, sleep disturbances, especially early waking or insomnia, not being able to sleep. But for some people, it's sleeping too much, sleeping a lot, restlessness or irritability. In men, depression sometimes presents as anger or irritability, and that's not a typical part of the diagnosis, but sometimes it shows that way in men. Sluggishness, like you were speaking of before, fatigue and loss of energy, difficulty concentrating. Sometimes people talk about not being able to digest what they're reading, for example. Their comprehension isn't as good. Difficulty making decisions, forgetfulness and confusion. Feelings of worthlessness or inappropriate guilt. Thoughts of death or suicide. And isolating oneself. And then a last one that I'm just adding here is unexplained aches and pains. Because sometimes things like headaches or backaches or digestive problems or chronic pain, for which they can't find any medical diagnosis, can actually point to a diagnosis of depression. So for a diagnosis of a major depressive disorder, which is a really serious impairing depression, sometimes often with suicidal thoughts, one would need to have four of that long list that I just named, plus either a depressed mood or decreased interest in activities for most of the time. The other types of depression are variations on that theme with lesser amounts of those symptoms, but can also be very serious. For example, another category of depression is called dysthymia. And that is a mild depression that lasts a long time. So to diagnose that, you would need about three of the symptoms that I listed, but they would go on over 2 years or more. And one source that I just recently read about described dysthymia as the epidemic common cold of mental health.
Wow.
Yeah, so it's sort
of... Interesting.
Yeah, so there's a lot more attention being paid to this long low-level depression, and that can be quite debilitating, too, over time.
Mm-hmm.
Can cause a lot of unhappiness in life, quality of life, and is also very treatable, both with psychotherapy and medication management. And then before something would become dysthymia, if it were that kind of low-level depression that lasted for a shorter period of time, that would have another diagnosis, which would be a depressive disorder not otherwise specified, which means that the symptoms for depression are there, but it's not as full-blown as either a dysthymia or a major depression.
Now, one of the things that I think is an intriguing question is the way in which depression is different from just being sad,
mm-hmm.
or just feeling like you have a case of the blues,
right.
Because sometimes that's what life brings us. I mean, sometimes your favorite team loses, or something worse. You lose your job, or your girlfriend breaks up with you, or your child has a drug problem. I mean, there's all kinds of unhappy things which can occur, and it's only normal to react with some sadness and even maybe in certain cases despair if it's a really serious problem that has no simple solution or maybe no solution at all. How does one sort out depression from just normal, understandable sadness that life might bring?
Well, usually for sadness, there is a precipitating event. I mean, you were speaking of the normal reaction to a loss or a disappointment, loss of a job, loss of a relationship, and or a loss of a dream, or even a loss of health in some way. Those all have will bring a sadness, and that would be very normal. And often when people come into my office and they may have a number of things that are contributing and they feel depressed or sad, then I frequently normalize that and say, well, if you weren't feeling sad or if you weren't feeling depressed with these things, I think there was something wrong with you. So having a reaction, a sad or a down reaction to life events is very normal. And often we don't think it should be. In fact, sometimes I see people in my office who don't realize that that is a normal reaction. But so sadness or the blues or grief is a normal reaction to life situations. And in differentiating that from depression, sometimes it's kind of hard to do. Part of usually sadness, if it's a reaction to an event, will get better over time. And even though the time could stretch on over some length, for example, if a partner dies or something like that, still people generally feel better over time. And it rarely produces thoughts of suicide. I mean, the person feels more like they're still their themselves, their own self, but they're sad. The difficulty in differentiating sadness from depression is that the symptoms can sometimes be the same. Certainly, I had talked about depressed mood and decreased interest in activities. That could certainly be the case if somebody close to you dies, or you go through a relationship breakup, or you lose a job.
Right.
But with depression, often there are multiple symptoms. For example, one's thoughts may be very different. Depressed thoughts are very negative. Mm. The kinds of things like, I'm a failure, or, you know, kind of some automatic negative thinking.
And things like, I suppose, like, I wish I'd never been born,
yeah,
or nobody in the world cares about me.
Right, or those kinds of thoughts. Or they can even be more subtle, like just seeing the kind of an overall pessimism. And that's not usually the case with sadness. I mean, people realize something happened to them, but it isn't their whole thought process that's shifting.
Hmm.
And as well with depression, a clinical depression, there can be more body pain and things like that. So that would be one way to diagnose the difference. However, if somebody is experiencing a loss and they're having a great deal of difficulty with some of the symptoms that I listed, even though it may not be a clinical depression in the sense that it's closely related to a life event, they could still benefit from some short-term treatment.
I think you had mentioned at one point that there are certain things which can make people vulnerable to depression, and I suppose to some extent we're all vulnerable to depression. Mm-hmm. It's a possibility for all of us, but are there certain factors which can create maybe higher levels of vulnerability?
Yes, and the whole diagnosing depression is an inexact science. It's getting a lot more exact, though. And just a sidelight, I recently read a book where some doctors were able to do brain scans of people with depression and anxiety and were able to sort those brain scans into different combinations, and then they would target the treatment according to those brain scans.
Hmm.
So that certain medications and certain types of treatments worked for those particular types. And so that's kind of a new development on the horizon.
Wow.
And kind of supports the idea of depression as a brain disease as opposed to whatever we would talk about that might have more stigma.
Yeah, right.
So there's some positive in that. But some of the things that might make a person vulnerable to depression are things like chronic stress or loss over time. Sometimes those can be from outer factors, and sometimes a person can just be a sort of high-stress type person, I guess.
Mm.
Living with a chronically ill or depressed person can actually be a chronic stressor that can make a person vulnerable to depression. Medical illnesses, like we talked about before, can make a person vulnerable to depression. Some, such as thyroid disorders or other endocrine disorders, can actually have symptoms of depression involved with them. Substance abuse can make a person vulnerable. Alcohol is a depressant, and used over time can increase the likelihood of a clinical depression. A family history or personal history of mood disorders, there is a genetic predisposition to most mental health problems. And as well in the treatment, if a family member has been treated successfully in some way, that also bodes well for the treatment of somebody who is newly diagnosed with depression. Certainly, people wouldn't be surprised to hear that chronic pain makes a person vulnerable to depression. Living in pain every day is just very depressing and contributes to hopelessness about life. Certain medications can contribute to or increase the likelihood of depression or even bring depressive symptoms on. Some of those medications would be treatments possibly for blood pressure, high blood pressure or cholesterol, some for chronic pain, some for heart disease, and some contraceptives also contribute to depressive symptoms. And also, and all of these symptoms or all of these contributing factors can lead to an imbalance of neurotransmitters in the brain. And we hear a lot of talk about that, about the serotonin and all of this in the brain when we see the commercials on TV or hear about that. But there's some thought that the levels of these various neurotransmitters and chemicals in the brain, when they're depleted, cause a, or contribute to a clinical depression, and that's what medications are designed to sort of target.
And to pull back into balance, I suppose.
Yes.
We're speaking with psychotherapist Amy Sprague-Champeau, talking today about depression in anticipation of National Depression Screening Day, which is this Thursday, the 7th of October. As a matter of fact, Amy Sprague-Champeau in her office will be offering free depression screenings on Thursday, and there are other places, too, where such screenings will be possible. Amy, you quoted an interesting statistic before we went on the air. I don't think you've mentioned it yet, about how this breaks down between men and women.
Right. Of the people affected by depression, one out of four women and one out of 10 men will experience a depressive episode in their lifetime. So that's a really high number of people. And I think we were talking also that the number of men might be higher, except that men don't identify themselves as depressed, and often may deal with, and it can look different in men, as I said before, that it may present more as irritability or anger as opposed to some of these other symptoms that I listed. And men tend to more often self-medicate by overwork or by other types of endeavors. But that's, and twice as many women as men are diagnosed with depression. So, but interestingly, for a bipolar disorder, which we didn't talk about, which used to be known as manic depression, men and women are equally at risk. So, and that's a different problem that is serious, too. So.
One of the things about depression, I suppose, that is a help now is that I'm guessing that people are a bit more open about their depressed state compared to some. I mean, to let's say a generation ago, where I would guess that a typical person would not feel particularly open or comfortable about talking about being depressed, especially if it's someone maybe in the middle of a life that had every indication of being a happy life. I mean, you wouldn't easily reveal to even close friends that you had these feelings so contradictory to the way your life should have played out. And now it seems like we live in a culture where we aren't quite so reluctant to share the darker sides of our experience. Is that an oversimplification?
Well, I think that the stigma of all mental health disorders has been reduced because celebrities have come out. You know, I'm thinking of Mike Wallace, the journalist, television journalist, who had suffered depression and has been really vocal. I think he's even worked in some of the national depression organizations to speak out about his depression, and others have spoken out, and that's helped a lot. And of course, many people are on antidepressants, so there's a commonality there, I think. But I still do feel that there is a stigma, and that people don't want. And some of it may depend on the geographical area in which people live, too. And I think in our geographical area, there still is a stigma about depression. I think it's easy to say the kind of thing, I'm so depressed that the Packers lost, or I'm depressed because I broke up with my girlfriend. But when it's the real kind of low black hole, when my clients come in, kind of this black hole, it... People, I mean, we still have a ways to go to make this as commonplace to discuss as our physical health issues.
Right. Yeah, we don't talk about it with that comfort.
And I think, too, with workplaces and things like that, where If you have a physical health issue and you can't go into work or your productivity isn't as good, that's really understood. Oh, you know, the person's had, I don't know what, the
knee surgery
mono or bronchitis or even something worse. But when it's depression or anxiety or something like that, it's a real gray area.
I thought when you started to broach this, we're talking about this part of the country, that maybe you were also thinking a little bit about kind of the work ethic that is part of our culture here, that that we are, I think we're in a part of the country where working hard is very much valued. It's probably valued through much of our country, but I think especially so in rural America in a lot of ways. I mean, you work hard, you kind of muscle your way through, and life kicks you in the chops, you dust yourself off and you get back up. And so in some respects, depression is so much in the face of that. Mm-hmm. And maybe that's something that maybe that makes it a little bit difficult for us to work with.
Yeah, and I don't know if that's necessarily with our geographical area, but it certainly does affect people who are depressed, because many of the people that come in to see me say, oh, people just say to try harder, to pick myself up by my bootstraps. And I think that is the thing that I hear the most from my depressed clients, is people just don't understand. And that probably is true, that if you haven't experienced what that feels like, it is hard to understand, because you can't really see it on the outside that much. Not like if you were wearing a cast, you know,
right,
or something. And that is, if anything, that kind of response from people's loved ones or employers does not help people who are depressed to feel better.
Maybe that's a way for us to understand what depression is, too, is that maybe it's a situation where you don't have your bootstraps anymore, or
yeah,
you can't reach your bootstraps the way that you normally would. I mean, it's amazing when, you can be hit with a terribly devastating thing. I mean, your house can burn down, or your children can be killed, or, I mean, something tremendously terrible can happen. And we often amazingly find ourselves with strength we never thought we'd have to contend with that. And I suppose in a depressed state, not only do we not have sort of the normal energy and resolve for a normal day, but much less so.
I think that's true, and that would be a good description of depression, or at least a clinical depression, that it's often very hard to reach one's resources.
Hmm.
You know, a person thinks, for example, oh, I could help myself if I exercised, prayed, meditated, went out, you know, did things. But the push to do those things is so much harder. So the very things that could be helpful, it's hard to get a person, you know, when a person is depressed, it's very hard to do that. It takes a very big amount of effort to do those things. And so it can be a vicious cycle. And one of the things, you know, and the treatments for people, I encourage them just to start doing the basics of self-care, because those things may have shifted away. So, for example, I encourage people to eat better. You know, to eat regularly, small meals throughout the day, and even if they're not hungry, to just sort of nibble on something, to give themselves more energy, or to be around supportive people or do things that are nurturing for themselves, and to just start to do a little bit of repair. And even some of those things are hard for people to do. And actually, in terms of psychotherapy, sometimes people can really benefit from psychotherapy alone. But when the depression is of the type that a person can't engage themselves to do those simple things, then sometimes medication is useful even for the person to be able to use psychotherapy.
Hmm.
So there are, you know, so some of that is what one would look for when a you know, I would look for when a person came to see me in my office.
It's interesting. I know a person with, I think, fairly serious depression who sleeps all the time, sleeps through the day, who probably would sleep every moment of the day if he or she could. Mm-hmm. What is going on when a depressed person sleeps so much? Or do we know why that occurs?
Well, I think I'm not sure if I can answer that question, and we may not know exactly what occurs. I think that, you know, it can be partly how the person's body is reacting to the depression itself, that they are just so tired. And sometimes it can be the effect of medications. And the neurotransmitters in the brain and all of that. I mean, I can't really sort that out. And sometimes people just feel better sleeping because they don't have to deal with things as well. So I think it can be a combination of many things. Hmm. I can't answer exactly why a particular person would be doing that.
It occurred to me to ask because, you know, when you say that you suggest people that are depressed need to try to engage in mm-hmm. self-care, and I can imagine, for instance, this person feeling like that's what they're doing when they just go back to bed and pull up the covers.
Right.
I mean, it's obviously a misguided
right.
way of caring for oneself.
I think that's a really good point, that I think that when people are doing things, they are really doing what they believe they need to do to help themselves. But it could be the depression speaking rather than the person in a way. So, for example, the same thing with isolating or wanting to be alone, the person could really be seeing that as self-care under the veil of depression. So, you know, those things may feel good at the time.
Amy, we've gotten a question from a caller that I think is interesting. He's wondering, and I think this is a very interesting question, he wants to know how the type of world we live in today might perhaps cause or affect depression. He mentioned that so many children grow up living in high-rise apartments, they don't get to play in neighborhood settings, you know, as their parents and grandparents did. There are physical threats to children, of course, that come in all kinds of shapes and sizes. So how much does depression have to do with the kind of world in which we live?
Well, first of all, I'm kind of excited that a caller called in a question. So, but I think that's a really good question. I think, and this is just my opinion, that the world that in which we live is one that contributes to kind of a chronic level of stress. And one of the sources that I was looking at in preparation for being on the radio today talked about such things as the September 11 and how that changed our world, and the fears and anxieties that people have about those kinds of things can contribute to kind of a low-level depression like dysthymia. In terms of some of the things that contribute to depression as well, there's some evidence that abuse and childhood abuse and neglect can also predispose people to depression later in life. So in terms of the caller's comments about children perhaps not having the supervision, not having the opportunity to be out, different family situations, all of those can contribute. I think that what those do is that they sort of build up chronically over time. And I'm thinking about actually my son and granddaughter, they live in Russia, and I have a little granddaughter there, and they had the bombing in Russia, the terrorist situation where so many children were killed, and that has really affected the families there, so that they don't go to malls and they stay away from public places and parents aren't sending their children to school, and so one could say that over time, this kind of fear that we have can certainly contribute, probably not as much to the major depression, which is kind of like a volcano, but more to the dysthymia, where it's can be a low-grade kind of thing. The other thing is that anxiety and depression are connected. And some of these things that we're talking about can contribute to anxiety as well. For example, a child who has to take on more responsibility than they should for their age because parents aren't home or somebody's ill or, you know, whatever. Situations where people live in fear, those can contribute to kind of a chronic anxiety state. And that over time can affect the hormones in the body. And, you know, so I do agree with the caller that those, that our world today is, we have to work harder to be able to relax, I think.
And probably have to work harder to stave off some of what would bring us depression in some way.
You know, I think that, maybe we need to be up on what's going on, but maybe not be saturated with it. I think being able to assess our level of commitment to activities, to prioritize, to kind of insulate ourselves a little bit, that's not a bad thing.
Does depression run in families?
Well, yes. The evidence is, again, this isn't all hard and fast science, you know, but it seems that there is a genetic predisposition that if a family member had some kind of a mental health problem, that it's more likely that other family members can develop depression or anxiety, actually. That it's often suggested that if one family member has had especially a major depression or dysthymia, that other family members might be screened for that. So there is, I think, a higher likelihood of mental illness or mental health problems in families where that's where a family member has had that.
We've already talked about how the treatment for depression can take the form of therapy, medication, or some combination of the two. I suspect that in addition to that, it maybe would be valuable for us to think about what we could do on behalf of someone else that we fear might be suffering from depression of one kind or another, be it a family member, a friend, a coworker.
Well, that's a good question. Actually, my presentation on Thursday night is called When Someone You Love Is Depressed, and that's going to be at Parkside. And I was going to say also that the things that we can do for ourselves if we happen to be depressed or a loved one of the best things we can do is to exercise. I mean, exercise is a natural antidepressant, and in some studies has been shown for mild depression to be as effective as medication over the long term.
Wow.
So a regular exercise several days during the week is something that can help a great deal. And if we happen to be living with someone who's depressed or very closely connected with somebody who's depressed that we care about, the first most important thing is to take care of yourself, the non-depressed person, because sometimes if people are living with a depressed person, they can the illness itself can take over to such a degree that those people, the caregivers, can become depressed. So number one is to take care of yourself, to exercise, to eat well, to not get burned out. But on top of that, there are things that people can do to help somebody who's depressed. One of them is to express concern, to listen, and to be empathic. That's the opposite of, come on, get on with it, pull yourself up by your bootstraps. Another thing that people can do, if they're really concerned about, they think somebody that they care about is depressed, is to find out information about depression and share it with the person. whether it's books. Sometimes there's a good book by Kathy Cronkite, and I can't remember the name of it, but it actually has interviews with well-known people who have experienced depression. Hmm. Something like that is sometimes a very non-stigmatizing thing to share with someone who's depressed, and also to learn about the resources in that person's particular area. And then to kind of plant seeds about getting help and water them often. But don't make that the total topic of conversation all the time, because then that will seem like nagging and people tend to turn that off.
What a nice way to put it, planting seeds. I mean, just because that's, I suppose, a good way to go about it, to just kind of get that idea lodged that this is something you don't have to just accept and tolerate.
Yeah, I think that also it's important that if you care about someone who's depressed, don't try to be their therapist. Listening, encouraging them to get help, also encouraging them to do some of the things that they don't want to do, like to get out, to go for, and one person even said that the best thing that someone can do for someone that's depressed is to go for walks with them. Because it's kind of a double thing. First, you can get the person moving physically, and also there can be talking, but if people aren't talking when they're walking, it's not uncomfortable, so that's something that people can do. For the person who's caring for somebody who's depressed, to not blame yourself. Sometimes when people are depressed, especially if it's a partnership situation, the depressed person might be sort of thinking the other person is the cause for these feelings. To not take that on is important. I think we were talking a little bit before we came on the air, Greg, about the importance of how much to do for the person. If the depressed person doesn't seem able to do their normal tasks, sometimes depression can actually make it so hard to accomplish the normal everyday tasks that maybe they might get behind on paying their bills or not be able to do certain things that they would normally do. And when a person is living with someone who's like this, sometimes they just step in and take over. And that can create this vicious cycle where one person is doing more and more, and the other person is doing less. So in that kind of situation, it's useful if you can kind of talk frankly with the person about what needs to be done and what they might need for help or how they can do those things, or maybe you can do them together, so that it isn't that then the depressed person becomes sort of less and less functional. They should be encouraged to do everything that they can on their own.
Amy Sprague-Champeau, this is such an important topic, and I'm really thankful that we could have this time to talk about it, and we certainly hope that this conversation has maybe made a positive difference for someone who either finds themselves battling depression or maybe someone whom they love. Amy Sprague-Champeau, we really appreciate your time in joining us today on The Morning Show. We look forward to your next visit.
Thanks, Greg.
This interview with therapist Amy Sprague-Champeau is from The Morning Show archives. It was recorded and initially broadcast back in 2004. If you would like to reach out to Amy Sprague-Champeau for further assistance or to have questions answered, you are invited to email her at amychampeau@gmail.com. That is AmyChampeau, amychampeau@gmail.com. Or you may text her at 262-412-0646. Again, 262-412-0646. I'm Gregory Berg. Tomorrow on The Morning Show, it is the monthly visit of Brian Albrecht, the president of Gateway Technical College. On Saturday's morning show, that's the podcast, of course, rather than the broadcast, you'll hear an interview from the archives about the history of the beauty industry, the author of a book called Inventing Beauty. Support for the morning show comes from Carthage College, where students can conduct NASA research, produce an original play, or join an in-house marketing agency as early as their freshman year. More information is available at carthage.com.